what climatologists call the dry corridor of Latin America, is because there's been a terrific drought. It drove people first into the violent cities of that region and then on the move. The predictions are that we can expect 140 to 300 million climate refugees over the next decades. We better come up with some better idea than just tear gassing people. Because this is the reality of the century that we find ourselves in.
And finally, the progress of the fuel divestment campaigns, Bill.
We're past $7 trillion in portfolios and endowments that have divested in part or in whole from fossil fuel companies. Shell Oil said earlier this year that divestment had become a material risk to its business. That's good news. We need to pressure the fossil fuel companies because ultimately, until their political power is broken, the chances of moving as quickly as we need to move are nil. So that's why movements
Bill,
like 350.org push it so hard.
We have to leave it there, but we want you to stay with us, and we want to thank you for being with us. We'll link to your piece in The New Yorker, How Extreme Weather is Shrinking the Planet, and Dr. Kristi Eby, Professor of Global Health at the University of Washington, Seattle. Thanks so much for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Board meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month, starting at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor the Portland Folk Music Society's concert season. On Friday, November 30th, the PFS concert features Patrick Ball and the Legends of the Celtic Harp in their program titled A Winter Gift. These three famed harpers perform Celtic legends and weave English and Irish literature with rare pieces of holiday music. The concert and storytelling event is at the Reedwood Friends Church, 2901 Southeast Steele in Portland, at 7:30 p.m. On January 18th next year, the Northwest band True North will bring their folk and bluegrass stylings to the PFS stage. For more information, go to the website kboo.fm and look on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time is 5:02 p.m. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, TriMet offers more ways to get home for the holidays, Portland police are implementing a new strategic plan, and in international news, a Syrian refugee has been granted asylum in Canada.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, November 26, 2018. I'm Carly Meisberger.
And I'm Rachel Hartley. In Portland, this past Friday, activists gathered outside City Hall for a Black Lives Matter, Not Black Friday event. They brought donations of blankets, food, and coats for houseless people in Portland. The idea of the event was to challenge the capitalist frenzy of Black Friday with an event that was supportive of the Black community without engaging in consumerism. KBOO's Jenka Soderberg was there and spoke with one of the organizers of the event.
We are outside of City Hall, the day known as Black Friday, big shopping day across the country. But here, Black Lives Matter has an alternative event to Black Friday. And I wonder, could you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about what is happening here today?
Hi, I'm Fendi, and today we are at City Hall. And we have organized a gathering where individuals have donated clothing, toiletries, food, and we're providing a community for people to congregate together and help, in hopes to help, you know? Help everyone out here. Not everyone, but those that we can reach out to. And in doing this type of work, we create community. So instead of celebrating Black Friday and going out and shopping and spending all of our money, we have organized an event where we don't support capitalism. We're not supporting capitalism in the traditional way. We're supporting each other in a community. So.
And how are the donations going to be distributed?
Individuals should be coming up here and grabbing donations, but we will also send teams out to disperse the donations.
And why City Hall as the choice of venue?
Why not? I guess for myself, becoming familiar with the idea of these places being open to the public and the individuals work inside of these places being employed to be public servants, you know, and we are out here doing the work to serve the public. And even in doing so, we are still being told to, can you scoot over and can you do this? Because the people inside our work are going to need to get out or whatever the case may be. But we're out here doing the work that essentially they should be out here helping and bagging stuff up. And that's what public service should consist of.
And were there any specific incidents that led you here in Portland to say, I'm going to take the stand and be an activist and actually go out there? Was there any specific event that led you to that conclusion?
There were actually a few events, but most of all, the main event that happened in my life, I got tired of acting like the issues that were going on in my community didn't matter. And what I realized with that is that I seen that the issues that were going on in my community were actually happening all around the world. So it was it wasn't only an issue that needed to be addressed in the community, but it's actually an issue that we need to address nationally. It's not a micro issue, it's a macro issue. And that issue for me was sexual violence in my community. And that's what drove me to becoming an advocate, an activist. And seeing my light seeing my light with being Black, with being a woman, and I now identify as a queer woman, just on numerous levels, this movement has helped me with my voice.
I know even here in so-called progressive Portland, there are those who criticize Black Lives Matter by saying it's divisive and somehow not uniting people. What would be your response to the people saying that?
My response to the people saying that would be exactly, you are the reason why we have the Black Lives Matter movement. Black Lives Matter doesn't mean that other lives don't matter. It doesn't, what we are, the fact that we have to say Black Lives Matter is a direct argument to those people.
Because in our society, historically, Black lives have not mattered.
Exactly. And for that to be a rebuttal to say that, oh, they're mean or they're being cruel, they're being divisive to say that Black Lives Matter. When has it been okay to say Black Lives Matter and for people to stand up with them and say, yes, they do matter? And period. You know? And I should not be ostracized because I want to say that, or I feel the need for people to believe that. And that type of rhetoric and that type of speech is just the reason why some of the hate is still, and some of those ideologies still belong in the world, because people still haven't grasped to understand that Black lives matter and need to matter on numerous systemic levels.
Yeah, there are some people that assume that it's saying only Black Lives Matter or that other lives don't matter, when the reality is that our society has shown time and again that they don't care about Black lives. And that's, do you see any difference here in Portland as far as the city government or the responses of the system here in Portland to Black Lives Matter, or is it critique and attacks like we see in other parts of the country?
Okay, let me answer that in two parts. One, I believe that as far as government officials are concerned, they don't have a sense of community to the Black Lives Matter, so a lot of them, should I say. There's a lack of representation of Black individuals in seats of office right now in Portland. So it makes sense to me that many people, especially in office, wouldn't understand what Black Lives Matter is. They don't have any identity attached to it, apparently. But as public servants, as I mentioned again, they need to get familiar with it because they are representing numerous individuals in the community. And they need to take that into account while being in office. As far as the rest of the world is concerned, I feel like as progressive as Portland gets its shine for, we're actually pretty far behind in a lot of ways. And the fact that we're actually talking about Black Lives Matter movement now, you know, in Portland, it's been happening for a while, but the fact that we're talking about it now shines light on that. Like, Portland still has a lot of work to do.
And we have just news that last night the Portland State University police had another person die in their custody. What do you think, as an activist here in Portland, should be done about that situation? Portland State University officers and Portland police.
It's funny because I literally just heard that on the radio on my way down here. And my first thought was they literally just had a meeting about this not too long ago. So when are you going to disarm PSU? Because obviously there's something that you guys are missing.
And one last question. Do you feel like there are some parallels between the mutual aid assistance programs of the Black Panther Party and in the 60s and 70s and what Black Lives Matter is trying to organize now with some of these drives to support the community in a positive way of just bringing food and clothing to people? Do you feel that there are parallels there, or do you get any inspiration from the Black Panther Party?
I think that's exactly what it is. It's inspiration. We look to our to people in our histories and to our ancestors, in a way, to show us the way. So what they did was they implemented a way for us. They showed us a way, which was radical at the moment. They got slack for it because of whatever type of reasons, and then we just continued the cycle of that type of behavior. I mean, that type of pattern for the community. So, yes, definitely inspired by the Black Panther Party and movements of the sort.
Well, thanks very much. Again, I've been speaking with Fendi, one of the board members of the Black Lives Matter here in Portland. Thanks so much for speaking with me today, Fendi.
Thank you for wanting to speak with me.
This is Jinka Soderberg reporting for KBOO Radio from outside of City Hall at the Black Lives Matter, Not Black Friday event.
It's like 10. As the city of Sacramento waits to find out whether or not District Attorney Anne Marie Sherbert will press charges against the two police officers who shot and killed 22-year-old Stephon Clark in March as he stood in his grandparents' backyard holding a cell phone, Clark's older brother has decided to run for mayor of the city that was ripped apart by his brother's death. Stevante Clark, 25, filed paperwork on November 19th with the California Secretary of State to open two campaign finance committees, one of which is tied to his mayoral bid for the 2020 election, according to the Sacramento Bee. Clark, who has been a vocal critic of the city of Sacramento, its police department, as well as its current mayor, Daryl Steinberg, told the Bee, "I don't have the most experience. I'm not the smartest guy. At the same time, I'm from the city of Sacramento, and if there's anyone who's going to listen to the people of Sacramento and who knows the problems of Sacramento, it's me. Even though I did decide to run for mayor after the death of my brother, I'm not making this about me and retribution and revenge." Clark told the Bee that if he is elected, he will work to improve life in the city's underdeveloped communities. His plan of action includes opening resource centers in his brother's name throughout South Sacramento that would offer job training, computer labs, recreational opportunities, childcare, mentoring programs, and mental health therapists. Clark, who had a number of high-profile mental health hospitalizations following his brother's death, told the Bee, "Mental health is one of the biggest things I want to combat." He also has a list of police reforms grouped under what he calls the Clark Family Act that he plans to propose to city leaders. Those reforms include hiring more officers of color who grew up in and are familiar with urban areas. He would also like to see more department-mandated training for officers on use of force, implicit bias in gang politics, as well as more community outreach, including weekly ride-along programs for youth. If he fails in his bid for mayor, Clark told The Bee he plans to move out of state.
A man who was detained by officers on Thanksgiving later died at a local hospital. He was identified as on Friday as 52-year-old Richard A. Berry. Around 8:19 p.m. on Thursday night, Portland State University police responded to calls about a man running and yelling near Southwest 6th Avenue and Southwest Mill Street. PSU officers reportedly called Portland police for backup after a struggle with the man. He was then restrained and placed in an ambulance. Recent records show Richard Berry listed his address as a homeless housing shelter downtown. The Portland Police Bureau release says, at this time, investigators believe the man suffered a medical event and died while receiving treatment. An autopsy is being performed to determine the cause of death. Homicide detectives, along with the Bureau's Professional Standards Division, are investigating the incident, and the results will be reviewed by the Multnomah County District Attorney. Two Portland police officers and four PSU campus officers are on paid administrative leave while the investigation is underway. Berry is the second person to die in a police altercation involving PSU officers this year.
A collection of vintage clothing and accessories from the original Meyer & Frank department store in downtown Portland is returning to the historic building this fall in a new window display designed by Oregon State University students. The display, which showcases the history of the Meyer & Frank building and fashion through time, was installed in a space made available to OSU's College of Business by the Nines Hotel, which occupies the building's top floors. The window is located on Morrison Street to the right of the Nines entrance. Oregon State is the Nines' newest neighbor in the iconic Meyer & Frank building. The university is leasing the second floor of the building for its new Portland Center. Classes began in the freshly remodeled 39,500-square-foot space in September. The display also includes accessories and a panel of text to provide information for the window gazer strolling by. The lead window designer, Jaeger, is a senior apparel major from the Eugene area who is interested in a career in historical fashion or museum work. Jaeger was assisted by friend and classmate Jordan Ferris. The display is expected to remain in place for about 3 or 4 months through the busy holiday shopping season. Nancy Clayton, Director of Sales and Marketing for the hotel, said there may be opportunities to showcase additional pieces from the OSU collection in the space in the future.
The Portland Police Bureau is in the early stages of developing its strategic plan for the next 5 years and would like public input. This 15-minute online survey includes questions on how PPB, Portland Police Bureau, can go about achieving the goals set forth by Police Chief Danielle Outlaw. To take the survey, visit portlandoregon.gov. Corrigo Group, a professional consulting firm, is conducting this survey on behalf of the Police Bureau. Results of this survey will be included in a strategic planning report that will be presented by Corrigo in early 2019. All responses will be kept confidential and identifying information will be kept private.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
National Native News, I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Whitefish First Nation shared concerns about the Trans Mountain Pipeline Expansion Project during a hearing in Canada last week. The National Energy Board began proceedings with Indigenous groups in Calgary. The Whitefish First Nation is a Cree community in northern Alberta. Four people from the community discussed the environment, threats to marine life from possible increased traffic, and impacts on future generations. Herman Sutherland expressed worry about oil spills.
The way they got these pipelines, it's going through the mountains, so everything's going to come back into our traditional country, into our traditional lands, where a lot of the medicines and herbs are. It's going to affect all of our people in all kinds of ways. Right now, it's not affecting us too much, but as soon as it goes through, what's going to happen is you're going to have big oil booms in the north, and there's going to be more pipelines, more damage to our lands, more damage to our waters. My ways and my beliefs are right here in my portfolio. This is my portfolio with my medicinal medicines and herbs. And I'd like to try to save that as much as I can and as much as the history goes.
Indigenous groups from Canada and the U.S. are invited to give testimony. In August, a Canadian court struck down the pipeline expansion approval, citing inadequate Indigenous consultation and environmental concerns. The Canadian government purchased the pipeline, and expansion would increase the amount of crude oil shipped to the U.S. Some First Nations are in support of the project for jobs and economic development, while others in Canada and the U.S. have expressed their opposition. Consultations are being held in British Columbia this week and continue through early December. Regulators are preparing to reconsider approval of the project. The Navajo Nation has filed a lawsuit in federal court against Arizona officials over voting rights of Navajo citizens. The Navajo Nation alleges Navajo voters have unequal access to voting and were denied equal protection in the November 6, 2018 election. The lawsuit claims Navajo voters have few opportunities to register to vote and participate in early voting. Disparities include slow mail service on the reservation and long driving distances to voting sites. Prior to the midterm elections, the tribe requested three counties provide additional access to in-person registration and early voting, which were denied. The tribe claims, as a result, Navajo voters have suffered. A hearing is scheduled for Monday in Phoenix. An Ohio school district is dropping its Indian mascot. The Talawanda School Board recently voted 3-2, the Cincinnati Inquirer reports. The board voted to change the name from Braves to Brave and phase out the mascot. Changing the Indian mascot has reportedly been debated for more than a decade. In recent years, Native American students in the district requested the Indian mascot be dropped. A collaboration between Native groups and the Tsleil-Waututh tribe is seeking to create affordable housing in Portland. 59 units are in the works for tribal members and other Native families in the city. The funding is from the tribe's Indian Housing Block grant. A groundbreaking for the project was held last week. Native organizations are also partnering to deliver on-site behavioral health, dental, and recovery services with traditional services nearby. Partners in the project say displacement is a major issue for the Portland Native community due to high rental and housing costs for low-income households. The housing units will be a step towards bringing Native people closer together. The units will be reserved for members of federally recognized tribes. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding is by Odawi Law Group, provider of Indian Law Solutions, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite System.
PBS wants to hear from you. Are you watching the four-part series Native America on your local PBS station? PBS wants to know how you continue your cultural knowledge and tradition. PBS is collecting stories like yours at pbs.org/native voices. Support by AARP. AARP creates and connects people to unique tools and programs, helps conserve personal resources, and tackles issues that matter most to individuals, families, and communities. More at aarp.org.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on Palestine. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather is 55 degrees with showers. Tomorrow's weather is 56 degrees with showers. Today in history, National Negro Medical Association was founded in the year 1895. And today marks the day Sojourner Truth died in 1883. The quote of the day is from Sojourner Truth herself. And quote, "If women want any rights more than they's got, why don't they just take them and not be talking about it?"
Visitors to Seattle's Woodland Park Zoo are able to view the first successful birth of red pandas in nearly three decades. The zoo introduced the twin red panda cubs at a public outdoor exhibit on November 23rd. Sisters Zaya and Ila, have been living in an indoor, climate-controlled area with their mom, Hazel, since they were born in June. Zoo officials say the cubs have been climbing trees, hanging out in high hammocks, and developing other motor skills. Red pandas are endangered, and fewer than 10,000 remain in the bamboo forests of China, the Himalayas, and Myanmar. Hazel was brought to the zoo 2 years ago as part of a conservation breeding program.
In a new report from the Oregon Department of Education, nearly 22,000 Oregon students don't have a place to call home. Homelessness can have a devastating effect on students, often reducing their chances for success in the future. The report notes that only 60% of homeless students are on track to graduate, compared to 85% of students overall. Since ODE began reporting on this data in 2012, there has been a 20% increase in the number of homeless students. Beaverton has the most homeless students in the state, with almost 1,800 students classified as homeless. Medford has the second highest number of homeless students in the state. The group Stable Homes for Oregon Families said in a press release that, and quote, "statewide tenant protections will stop no-cause evictions and rent spikes that force children and families onto the streets, into their cars, or hopping from couch to couch. Lawmakers must act in 2019. Families need protections and stability to stay housed, and students need homes to succeed in school."
The August Wilson Red Door Project presents the premiere of Cop Out, Beyond Black, White, and Blue. Cop Out is a series of monologues based on interviews with police officers from across the country. The Red Door Project commissioned writers to interview cops, mostly officers of color, who are often caught in the middle of the complex conversation on racial profiling. The stories in Cop Out reflect this complexity and breadth of lived experience. Cop Out is the next step in the journey that began with the Red Door's production of the new Black Fest's Hands Up, Seven Playwrights, Seven Testaments. Hands Up was written by seven Black playwrights about their experiences with police profiling in the wake of Michael Brown's death in Ferguson. The Red Door's production of Hands Up has been a phenomenon in Portland and other cities in the Northwest. Over 12,000 people have seen it and remarked on both its authenticity and power to open eyes and touch hearts. Don't miss the premiere of this new play that has been described as a challenging, moving, important evening of theater. Powerful, transformative, and amazingly authentic. The play is happening November 30th at 7:30, December 1st at 7:30, and December 2nd at 2 p.m. It will be at the Self Enhancement Inc. at 3920 North Kirby Ave in Portland. They also believe that art should be accessible to all, and therefore tickets are pay what you can. The suggested donation is $20, but no one will be turned away for lack of funds.
Holiday travelers will have more options to catch late or early flights this year using TriMet trains and buses. Max Red Line trains now provide direct service to and from the terminal approximately every 15 minutes most of the day. The new bus line, the 272 PDX night bus, serves PDX between 2 a.m. and 4 a.m. when the Red Line isn't running and creates a 24-hour connection to the airport. Line 20 Burnside/Stark, one of our two 24-hour bus lines, also connects to the new 272 line.
A series of protests Saturday resulted in a mostly peaceful separation of right-wing and counter-protesting left-wing demonstrators by Portland police. However, the protests devolved into some skirmishes near the end of the planned event, and six people were arrested.
The protests took place in a pair of parks near Portland City Hall downtown. Left-wing protesters started mobilizing Saturday morning in response to a planned demonstration later in the day by an offshoot of the right-wing group Patriot Prayer, which rallied in support of the so-called Hymn to movement, which claims that men are being oppressed and abused by unfair prosecutions of sexual assault, a response to the Me Too movement. By late afternoon, Portland police and other law enforcement officers successfully separated the two sides for more than 3 hours, shutting down a portion of Chapman Square and some sidewalks adjacent to Terry Schwenk Plaza. When the Patriot Prayer group appeared to disperse but held an impromptu march downtown, some skirmishes broke out when they intentionally tried to clash with masked, black-clad anti-fascists. Police gave dispersal orders to the crowd, but it failed to de-escalate the situation. The assaultive behavior by some of the people attending the protests included throwing projectiles at demonstrators and officers. These included sticks, glass bottles, lit road flares, bottles filled with what police believed was urine, and gopher gas. Police said they used a rubber ball distraction device for crowd control. 6 people were arrested, including 5 charged with interfering with a peace officer. Portland Police Chief Danielle Outlaw released a statement shortly after the protests. The Portland Police Bureau spent considerable time planning for today's demonstration and counter-demonstration, Outlaw said. We used significant resources and attempted to keep opposing groups apart, both when they were in the parks and as they traveled through downtown. Our goal was to keep all people in the community safe. The demonstrations came on the heels of a decision by City Council to reject a proposed emergency ordinance from Mayor Ted Wheeler and backed by Outlaw that would have given Wheeler the power to dictate time, place, and manner regulations for demonstrations when there's a threat of violence and other special circumstances. The ordinance would have allowed for more tools for use outside of a park that don't already exist in code, Wheeler tweeted as the demonstrations were winding down Saturday.
A Palestinian nurse from Bethlehem was gunned down by Israeli forces on Monday when he was driving to work in Hebron. His vehicle was involved in a collision, and Israeli soldiers immediately began firing, killing the 32-year-old father of 2. Israeli forces said a soldier was injured in the incident, which they claimed a deliberate car ramming attack, before the army shot and killed the driver. In a statement, the army said the incident took place on Route 60 in an area where road work is taking place. The Palestinian Red Crescent Society stated that one of its ambulances rushed to the scene, and medics began providing treatment to the severely wounded Palestinian. They loaded him into the ambulance and tried to move him to a hospital, but the Israeli soldiers stopped their ambulance. An Israeli soldier looked at a cartograph machine hooked to the Palestinian and said, "He is dead. We are taking his body," end quote. The soldier then took the severely wounded man from the ambulance, placed his corpse in a black bag, and took it away. The soldiers then asked the Palestinian medics for 2 neck braces, which were given to them. It should be noted that Israeli forces frequently misclassify vehicle collisions between Palestinian and Israeli vehicles as, and quote, deliberate ramming attacks, when many are likely accidents. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, November 26, 2018. Here are the main points again. TriMet offers more access, Portland Police's strategic plan, and in international news, a Palestinian nurse is shot and killed. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Rachel Hartley, Carly Meisberger, and our engineer is Danielle Parks. The director of the Evening News and Public Affairs is Rachel Hartley. A podcast and transcript of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Palomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Rachel Hartley.
And I'm Carly Meisberger.
Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show covers politics, history, and the state of the Zetiest with a liberal dose of listener calls. At 9, on Alternative Radio, Stephen Bezruchka outlines some of the ways that inequalities can be deadly. At 10, you'll hear Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, Stage and Studio Talks to the artistic director of the August Wilson Red Door Project about their production cop-out, Beyond Black, White, and Blue. And at 11:30, Art Focus interviews Robert Hoffman of the American Institute of Architects about the 2018 AIA Portland Architecture Awards. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member or donate, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
For our KBOO In Depth this evening, tune in to a very special interview regarding Palestine and a recent boycott that has been brought about by a collective about and trying to retain about a conference in UCLA. KBOO has their story.
With us is Heidi Lee. She's an alumni of the Students for Justice in Palestine group, also known as SJP. So Heidi, if you could just introduce yourself, give us a little bit of background and what the group SJP represents.
Okay, so I have been an organizer in the Palestine Solidarity Movement for about 8 years, as well as BDS, which is the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanction Movement, connected to SJP, Students for Justice in Palestine. SJP is a student network on campuses organizing around educating people on Palestine and bringing different organizers together to develop education and just to kind of educate folks on campus about the issue. And they have a conference every year that's been going on. I think this past weekend was the 10th conference that they've held. So that's how I've been connected to it. Perfect. And even after I graduated, I've still been doing work around that issue on Palestine. So, mm-hmm.
And SJP is in support of the BDS movement, the Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions.
Yes.
And so what is BDS and how, let's see, what should I ask? How has the BDS movement in general been silenced in the U.S.?
So the tactics that happened, which I guess we'll get into later, at UCLA toward the SJP conference are the same tactics that have been wielded against the BDS movement. So the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanction Movement was founded in 2005 by Palestinian civil society groups within the West Bank and Gaza, collectively civil society, not part of any of the formal political institutions like the Palestinian Authority and some of the other ones, which advocate for equal rights for all Palestinians, the right of return. And so through that advocacy, there's been a lot of repression because of the charge and accusation that standing in solidarity with Palestinians who just want equal rights and equality for all means that that it's an anti-Semitic movement. Mm-hmm. However, we also, the BDS movement works very closely with Jewish Voice for Peace, which is JVP, which is a national organization of anti-Zionist Jewish organizers who educate around the issue about the distinctions between Zionism and Judaism. And we are talking about the political entity of Zionism and not ever talking about the religion, which we fully respect. So because there's a lot of misunderstanding, a lot of propaganda, a lot of disinformation out there about Palestine in general, it's very easy for them to paint BDS with a broad brush and to say that, you know, that what we stand for is against anything that has to do with Judaism, rather than what we're talking about is the political state of Israel, which represses Palestinians through the occupation and the apartheid laws and the rules that exist. So that's, hopefully that's helpful.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, it's also so interesting because Super at U of O, you know, we also worked with Decolonizing Judaism, which was a group on campus, and we worked really closely with them when we were trying to pass the BDS resolution. And many of the Zionists on campus that opposed the bill said that we were silencing Jewish voices. But it was interesting because they were completely disregarding the Jewish people that we were working with. So yeah. it's a completely ironic and hypocritical situation. But anyway, so getting back to UCLA, what's going on there now? Yeah, so you said it's the 10th annual SJP conference at UCLA. So specifically, what sort of pushback have you all received from the administration and other opposing groups on campus?
So I can speak to it not as in depth as somebody who's been, you know, a student organizing for SJP on the campus, but having been there for the whole weekend, I got a pretty good handle of what was occurring. So, and I'll just go back to what you shared about what you dealt with in Super. We dealt with the same thing when we were trying to get the BDS resolution passed through the Student Senate, which we did successfully. So I can totally relate to, we heard the same tactic that you talked about. So fast forward to SJP at UCLA. UCLA has a heavy presence of Zionist student groups on campus and one main Palestinian organizing group, which is Students for Justice in Palestine, SJP. So they're always dealing with backlash of trying to organize around the politics of anti-occupation, anti-imperialism, standing in solidarity with Palestinians on an anti-Zionist platform. Mm-hmm. So with that success comes a lot of backlash from the Zionist student groups. And so what they did was, in partnership with some community Zionist community groups in Los Angeles, collectively they went to the LA City Council. And they tried to bring charges of that SJP is anti-Semitic, it's racist against Jewish people, and that they should shut down the conference based upon that platform. However, UCLA, SJP at UCLA was able to successfully argue that, no, this is what we're about, and they were the Zionists were not successful in shutting down the conference. However, throughout the weekend, and this conference ran this past weekend from Friday through Sunday afternoon, there were tactics by the administration to get at SJP in a different way, meaning we went about a minute over on audio on Saturday night, and they tried to charge them $500. They tried to charge them for distributing water bottles to everybody, so getting water to conference participants. And we had to resort to security presence, which a lot of Palestinians have a lot of, especially those coming from living under occupation, still very kind of triggered by, but the Zionist repression was already happening as of Friday. So we had to actually redirect where we were entering. There was a huge amount of security by student organizers as well as campus organizers. National Lawyers Guild came to witness what was going on. So we're able to subvert that. But then on Sunday afternoon, they showed up in full force outside the building, Dodd Hall to be specific, where we were holding sessions and talks. For instance, I was in a talk about refugees in Lebanon. Other people were talking about just the different situation Palestinians living under occupation. And so Palestinian organizers, while trying to talk about that struggle, had to hear chanting and shouting that they wanted them to go away. It was extremely intense. And I was, you know, we weren't quite sure what was going to happen, but we decided, everybody collectively decided that we would stay through the sessions and then we would move as a group over to the larger ballroom where we're going to finish up the conference. Mm-hmm. Along that route, it was about 400 to 500 of us on the side of equal rights and justice for Palestinians and on a, you know, an anti-racist, anti-Zionist platform marching together collectively with security, while about 100 Zionists shouted just really vile, terrible things at specifically Palestinians and saying really inflammatory things. And so a lot of us who are not Palestinian were kind of shielding people. They were also trying to take pictures so they could create more canary mission profiles. And I was like, hey, I've already got one. Take pictures away. I used my keffiyeh to shield Palestinians so that they could get through. Super intense. And we made it through to the ballroom. That was about a 15-minute process. And it was, like I said, so that's what we're dealing with. Mm-hmm. And so then we got to the ballroom. We had been organizing, having lunch, and then a couple of Zionist infiltrators got through into a maintenance area and got up on stage and held up some stuff. And we had to do de-escalation tactics to get them out of the ballroom. And then we eventually had to, we decided collectively around 2 to shut down the conference early for everyone's safety. Those of us moved in groups. We went to go get lifts to get back to the airport, and there were a bunch of Zionist tours trying to surround us and take pictures and saying really nasty things. Again, many of us who are not Palestinian were kind of just trying to protect those students. Mm-hmm. But, you know, sharing keffiyehs to shield people's faces, and, you know, I was kind of like, hey, go ahead, bring it on. I will, you know, so I kind of was like shielding people. Many of us were doing that. That was what the weekend consisted of. However, the victory is that the conference went on. There were the most participants we've ever had, and people left there with an emboldened feeling of we're going to continue to do this work, and despite what Palestinians in the occupied territories deal with, and despite what we deal with here, we know we're on the right side of history. This is the right thing. We believe in equal justice and rights for all Palestinians and the right of return for the refugees and the end of the apartheid state and the occupation. So that is, like, I know that's a lot, but that kind of gives you an idea of what basically took place. But that is a snapshot of what's happening around the globe for what people do when you deal with Palestine and what you're doing this work as an organizer. So
to me, it's a huge victory that you got 400 to 500 people to show up. I mean, like, mm-hmm. again, I'm comparing this to my small experience at U of O or at University of Oregon, but like, we had maybe 20 people supporting us, and the rest was a room full of pro-Zionist people. And I mean, it was like 200 people. And so we were up against this huge wall of opposition. And so that alone, like, the support that you could garner is, that's really inspirational to me. But I read something about the UCLA administration not allowing people to fly kites, Palestinian kites, or can you briefly go into that? Because Israel just recently passed, or at least they were trying to pass a law to make Palestinian flag flying illegal in Israel, and so I just saw like a small parallel between the two.
Yeah, so what that gets at to, which you you're probably already familiar with, which I'm sure you'll cover, the Great March of Return.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there's been releasing of balloons and kite flying as a symbol of, you know, we want freedom, people doing it in solidarity. And so there's that direct link with what's happening at the Great March of Return in Gaza, and then other actions, Friday protests and stuff in the West Bank, directly linked to UCLA, SDP at UCLA, in solidarity with that, decided to use the logo of the Black Bear, which is something that's tied to a UCLA mascot. Mm. And so the symbol on the shirts and kind of the theme, you know, everyone kind of has a theme and a T-shirt for each year of the conference, was a Black Bear sitting down with a keffiyeh, which is the traditional solidarity symbol, very historical black and white scarf, which many people have seen. And then the bear is kind of holding on to some kites. Mm. That's flying and kind of flying around. And so there's that direct link of solidarity with what's happening on campus to what's happening at the Great March of Return. So that cultural connection, as well as that resistance against the occupation. And so then UCLA tried to shut down the use of that mascot because they said that's specifically for UCLA, and SGP organizers were like, well, we're students at UCLA. And we feel like we should be able to use that symbol. We're a student group. We're a recognized student group on this campus, so we feel like it's all right for us to go ahead and use. So that was just another tactic that they tried to use against the organizers.
Right, as a way to silence, yeah.
Exactly, at every step. And I would be remiss if I didn't share one of the most amazing things that happened over the weekend, and I've got video of this, is that the spirit of Palestine, as you well know, I'm sure, is incredibly resilient and beautiful and gracious and joyful despite everything that's happened, right? It's very heavy work to do. But once the conference came to an end, somebody had turned on some traditional Arab music, and then Debka, which is the traditional Palestinian dance, kind of broke out. And so there was like a line of like 200 people.
Oh my God.
In the ballroom, kind of like, hey, we've been victorious. We dealt with all of this all the weekend, but this is what we do. We know. And just to be able to be a part of that is incredibly humbling and empowering at the same time. And just like, this is why I do it. It was just the culmination of just like, we will continue to struggle around this. We'll continue. And I believe Palestine will be free at some point. I think all of us that do this work know. I wish it would come sooner rather than later, but like, so, yeah.
I also admire your optimism and positivity because, I mean, there are times in when I'm reading the news or when I'm talking to my dad or I'm talking about this horrific situation that's going on, and I can't help but feel disheartened and discouraged and just like we're getting nowhere. Like we're taking one step forward and like 500 steps back. And just in your opinion, how, and I'm still trying to grapple with this, but how can groups like the Canary Mission and SJP Uncovered and like even the UCLA administration, how can they blatantly silence a peaceful human rights group like SJP? I mean, like SJP and BDS and Super, you know, and all of these different factions, they all, the forefront of their argument is human rights. It's like human rights is deserved by all. And it's peaceful. And I mean, BDS is the largest peaceful protest that we have for Palestinian human rights. And
yes,
it's just, it kind of baffles me how blatantly these groups can silence them and just reject them and call them anti-Semitic. And then once that word is used, it's like the group is done. You know, it's over. It's a, it's just so blatant. And I'm just wondering how it can be that way.
Well, first off, I would say that anyone listening to this would, if you're not familiar with the Boycott, Divest, and Eviction movement, I would first encourage people to go to BDSmovement.net, which is the direct website. And just to say, too, BDS is fully centered on the Palestinian perspective and narrative. And so most of the people doing organizing work within that movement are Palestinians. This is coming directly from the people, either living under occupation or displaced in the Palestinian diaspora as refugees, coming from the history of the Nakba and all those other things. With that said, what a lot of folks I don't think understand is that the state of Israel is pouring millions of dollars into anti-BDS legislation. There, at last count, I believe there was 22 states with pending anti-BDS legislation that many, not only Democrats and Republicans and Democrats, are also on board with that. There is a lot of money being, so student groups that are Zionist student groups that are on board and against anti-BDS can receive excess money that other student groups don't get as registered student groups from the state of Israel, millions and millions of dollars. And this is well-founded research. This is not anything I have to make up or exaggerate. This is actually the fact. They're very proud of what they're doing. I believe the reason why they're able to get away with it is because the misinformation about Palestine and the lack of education on what it means to be a settler colonial nation, occupation, what is apartheid, all of those things, right? The history prior to 1948, where Israel basically, what I say, became a state by hook or crook in a very shady process. But it goes back to the founding of the settler colonial nation and the British Mandate in the early 1900s, where Palestine was literally handed over to the Brits through a letter, a written letter by Lord Balfour. Now, what I just shared with you, which I know you know that, but I'm sure a lot of the listening audience doesn't understand that history of how Israel became a state, off of the backs and the oppression of Palestinians that were already living there peaceably with other Jews, Bedouin, you know, all kinds of cultures and people that were living there peaceably together. And so then when the British Mandate was put into force, that's when it became under occupation. And most people who have an opinion, I've been doing this work for, like I said, 8 years, and what I have seen in many different facets, whether it be on campus, whether it be at my job, whether it be just in conversation with people, family, friends who are not very knowledgeable, they don't know that it's like an actual occupation, and that it wasn't just, oh, they just kind of left their villages and they just kind of gave up and they've moved wherever. That's literally what people believe, and that Israel was founded because of the Holocaust, which you and I both know is not why it was founded.
Right.
You know, so I say all that for context, because if that is the case, if people don't know that history, then it was very, very easy to say what they're able to say and what they've been saying since 1948 about Palestine and Palestinians. And so they've been able to control the narrative. The other resource I really would love for people who are listening to this to watch is The Occupation of the American Mind, because
it's such a good, it's going so good.
Yeah, it's hard to watch. It talks about the way that the propaganda of the news, just even the words, the way they describe Israelis versus Palestinians. And also, I would say there's an Al Jazeera documentary that was suppressed but has been released publicly to show the dirty tactics that the Zionist movement overall uses to try and get their information out there to continue this campaign of propaganda. They have a huge APAC, which is the American Israeli Public Affairs Committee, which was the first lobby in the United States right after World War II ended to get millions of dollars. So the corrupt lobby culture that we have in Washington directly goes back to APAC. So this stuff has been in place for a very long time. And so I think this conversation is extremely important, because I bet there'll be people listening for the first time that don't know about it and are like, wow, I had no idea. Most well-meaning people that I come in contact with and I tell them about Palestine, they are generally like, what? I had no idea. And then also, like, we, the Palestine Solidarity Movement, we have the facts and history on our side. I know the Zionist history. I can contend with the Zionists because I know what Theodor Herzl said. I know what Jabotinsky said. I've read a lot of their history to understand exactly what their priorities were to try and steal all of the Palestinian land and to pretty much kick them out. And so when you know that, you understand exactly what these tactics are and how they're able to get away with it. But going back to what you said earlier, it is very disheartening. I mean, if I sound hopeful, it's because Palestinians still have hope, because I am pissed off half the time. I'm like, I don't understand. This is like, you know, there's so much misinformation. Nobody cares. It feels like a long fight. But because Palestinians living under occupation still have hope, they still go back to the Great Return March, whether they know they could be shot. Palestinian women living under occupation, being kicked out of their homes in a horrible section called Hebron, where they're just living there on the street, being kicked out of their homes, are still carrying on and taking care of their families and having hope that Palestine will be free. Like, that's why I continue to do what I do.
Yeah.
And this propaganda that they're trying to use against Palestine, I don't believe it's going to win. I say that still being very frustrated, but then, you know, that's... So, again, sorry, I'm being very long-winded, but I feel like there's so much information to cover.
No, it's great. People need the background to even understand what's going on in UCLA, you know? And also, I mean, just a side note, huge step, Airbnb just...
Yeah.
Removed all of their, or like took out, what did they do? Can you explain what they did? They like cut ties with the occupied territories, right?
Yeah. So the other thing that folks should do their research on is the settlements, which are illegal under international law. So literally the state of Israel, they were, you know, there in 1948, there was a certain section that was called Israel and Palestine. You have the West Bank and you have Gaza. However, in the West Bank, which is supposed to be contiguous Palestinian area at this point, are where the settlements are supplanted. So if you look at a map now, basically the West Bank looks like Swiss cheese, and settlements are illegal. They take over Palestinian land. So Airbnb has settlement houses or apartments that people can stay in. So, like, I could literally go on Airbnb and rent an Airbnb in a settlement, which is literally built on the top of a Palestinian village. The settlements is this whole entire issue. And so then, because Airbnb decided to take that stance, if you watch now what the State of Israel did, it's now creating all this backlash against that company. And we'll see if Airbnb succumbs to the pressure. Because what that speaks to, the larger question, is that the pressure on corporations and individuals when you go up against the Israeli state with all of the money and support they have from the United States and other countries like Canada and even Australia, it's almost insurmountable, and it's overwhelming, because it's sort of, as far as I'm concerned, Palestine is a litmus test. When people say they stand for social justice and all of these other causes, yet they cave on the issue of Palestine, it shows you very quickly exactly what those politics are. Right. So Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who has been this great radical fireball of this woman who's been elected, she was all for, you know, standing up for Palestine and possibly BDS, and then when she got elected, she had to kind of cave and kind of wimped out, quite honestly, on her stance on Palestine. So I will, it'll be interesting to see if Airbnb decides to back down and relent and then continue to let settlement people get Airbnbs in settlements.
It's still great that they even took the first step, you know? I mean, like, we see artists all over the world that don't take up the invitation to perform in Israel, and like Lana Del Rey and, you know, whoever else. It's still cool to see that, even if it doesn't go through all the way. Like, Airbnb is this massive corporation, and the fact that they even took one step is...
I mean, the amount of success that the BDS movement has had, and it was, like I said, 2005, so we're going on, 13 years?
Mm-hmm.
The success that the BDS movement has had compared to what the... and it is modeled after the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Which I'd like to just let the audience know that the only government that was in solidarity with South Africa and apartheid and on the side of the apartheidists during that time was Israel. Even the United States took a stand against apartheid in South Africa. So you find that the whole relationship with that. So every victory, but the BDS movement has had so many victories comparatively. And you know, that struggle stands on its own, but we also gain a lot of some encouragement from what they were able to accomplish.
Right.
In South Africa, there's also a lot of solidarity from South African comrades to the BDS movement. There's a huge BDS movement in South Africa. In Ireland, like, there's a lot of places around the world where we don't see it in the U.S. media.
Mm-hmm.
I referenced that documentary earlier, because I think if people get outside of